Welcome to today's program titled Preparing for the Trump Administration, What Employers May Expect. At this time, all participants are in listen-only mode. For those of you who are logged into the web presentation, you are encouraged to submit questions throughout the conference by selecting the chat pod located in the lower left corner of your screen, then type and send your question that way. At the end of today's event, a link to an online evaluation will be displayed on your screen. Please take a few minutes to complete it. We do appreciate your feedback. I would now like to introduce our hosts for today. Mike Killeen, you may begin.
Yes, good morning, everyone, and thanks for joining us across the country on what I think is a chilly day for just about everybody. As we know, the Trump cabinet is still being finalized, and the new Congress has yet to meet and set an agenda, but we already have a sense about what the Trump administration is likely to do to impact labor and employment law. We've assembled a panel here around the table of some subject matter experts. Some have actually worked for the agencies they're going to be discussing, and they're going to talk about the policy shift that we think is coming for employers in 2017. I'd like to begin with turning this over to Peter Finch, who's going to talk about the National Labor Relations Board. Peter?
Thank you, Mike. Now I'm going to seize control here. Well, good morning. As Mike indicated in his opening remarks, some of us here at the table have worked for the agencies we are going to be talking about, and I am one of those who has 15 years' experience with the National Labor Relations Board in regional offices and working in the Office of the General Counsel in Washington, D.C. So my talk is informed by my time in the various offices and headquarters, and then the last 5 or so years in private practice here at Davis Wright Tremaine, where my practice has been primarily traditional labor law, but as the board and the general counsel at the NLRB have expanded their authority, that's meant a lot of work with non-union employers coping with the assessment of their handbook rules, new election rules, and so on. So to get into it, as Mike said, there's been a lot of change so far. We've seen lots of surprising picks for cabinet positions. So we can expect, I think, lots of change at the NLRB. That change is going to be a little bit slow, and it might come in ways that we're not used to talking about change. And let me explain that. So the board is really three ideas, but one agency. The first that many of us think about as the board are the regional offices and the agents that we primarily deal with, the people that we call up and we get emails and letters from. Those are the people in the office closest to where we work. The board also is made up of 5 members, and those 5 members are 5 seats. They're not always 5 members, but those 5 members are all appointed by the president and confirmed by the Senate. There's also the general counsel, who kind of pushes the agenda of the regional offices and has the opportunity to do that through complaint and review of cases. And the makeup of the board, that 5-member panel, or the majority, traditionally favors the sitting administration. So the Obama board has been made up primarily, majority has been pro-labor or labor-leaning members. And a Trump administration, we can expect to see a more employer-friendly board. So the reason we're saying change is going to be coming slowly is that many of the key players of the board really aren't going anywhere. And that's because we've got the 3 members have got appointments that run through at least the end of this year and then beyond. The general counsel is going to be sitting at the NLRB through November. We may not hear about a new GC until late October. So we'll still have those folks working and kind of running the show behind the scenes. Another reason we don't see a lot of change is that the folks that we talk to day in and day out aren't going to be going anywhere. Those are generally career employees, and the principles that they're working with don't tend to change. Discrimination tends to look like discrimination regardless of who's in control, who's in the White House. What we talked about in terms of mechanics of bargaining don't generally change. So there's not going to see a lot of swing in those. But there is going to be some swing, and I think we're going to be surprised, and employers, I think, are going to be happily surprised. So the first thing we're going to get are 2 more members to the board. We're going to get those will be appointed by President-elect Trump, then President Trump. They'll be approved by the Senate probably very quickly, given the majority in both houses. And then that's going to tilt towards the GOP employer point of view. So there's lots of speculation about who those folks might be. I don't have any inside information. I wouldn't hazard a guess as to who it could be, but I imagine we're going to see some very outspoken, well-spoken people appointed to the board. The position of chairman is likely going to shift. A lot of people would expect it to go to member Miscamara, given his tenure, and he may be up for reappointment. That will depend mostly on what he wants to do. But those folks were going to get to work right away. There's no break-in period. They might get appointed and approved, and then they're at work the following Monday, moving in their office and having meetings about cases. So they're really going to get involved straight away. One thing I would note, there's an asterisk in all of this, is that you may have heard recently that there might be an ethics issue here, and that President-elect Trump, in his vast business holdings, also has a hotel division, including Trump International Hotel, which was recently found to have violated the National Labor Relations Act. So it'll be interesting to see how these new members are picked, how they're put forth, and whether or not there's going to be any outcry over that issue. So another way that we're going to see change is a slowdown for the National Labor Relations Board General Counsel. So Mr. Griffin has been able, in his position, as is his right, to identify some pet projects, some issues that he thinks need some specific focus, some areas of the law that he thinks need clarification or honing. And those choices have been to expand the definition of employee, expand the board influence in non-union settings, to act on the board's relatively recent expansion of the definition of joint employer. And we've seen that in a number of cases against McDonald's, where we traditionally think of them as franchises, but the NLRB has seen more of a control by the parent organization. There's an effort to identify some independent contractors working for employers like Uber or others in this gig economy that kind of run their own show from their own home, and they decide when and where to work. Are they employees or not? There's also been expanded use of injunctive relief when the general counsel believes that the unlawful activity needs to stop sooner than the board can act. He'll go into district court and try and get an injunction to get things put back to center. Those things, we can imagine there's going to be some slowdown, and there might be a very different approach given the new board. Two of the things that I think are most important to employers that we can see is the general counsel's initiative to severely restrict employers when they want to or they believe they're entitled to withdraw recognition from an incumbent union. As it is now, the employees can just show that the union has lost their support. A majority of employees no longer support the union. If the employer has a good faith doubt as to that majority support, the employer can withdraw recognition. The general counsel had been pushing for an election-only rule where there would have to be a private or a secret election run by the board to get to that withdrawal. I think that is probably dead in the water. And there was also initiatives to look for cases where employers, in justifying their rejection of proposals, pointed to the economic impact those would have. This is often called, you know, pleading poverty, that I can't agree to those terms, I'll go out of business, or I will lose my competitive advantage in the marketplace. Making those, there are no magic words, but there was an idea that when you plead poverty, that you would tacitly agreed to open up your books to the union so that they could see for themselves whether or not you could afford it, under the principle that if it's important enough to assert it, it's important enough to prove it. I think that is probably going to stay in place, and we may even see kind of a backing off, a retreat from the current case law on those subjects. I would not expect there to be a wholesale reversal of a lot of the troublesome decisions that we've seen from the Obama board. One thing that we can say about the NLRB is even when they make changes, they tend to be very deliberate and they tend to show their work. And by that, they will give a very detailed analysis and explain the law that supports their position, whether we agree or not. And we can, I think those who follow the NLRB, there might be many of you out there, but we know there have been almost every major decision has come with as long a dissent, and those dissents have been very passionate, and they've been important, and I think they can point the way to what we can expect. So member Miscamara, and looking back a little bit further, one of his Republican appointees, Harry Johnson, had some dissents that really should tell us what the path ahead might look like. Practically speaking, I think the biggest impact for non-union employers and union employers, but mostly the non-union employers who felt the pinch of the NLRB, will be a better test in the making for how to evaluate handbook rules. This has been an area of the law that has driven a lot of people batty. I mean, we have looked at rules that we think make a lot of sense in for our operations, and we know that they're important to us, and we have good reasons for them. The board, though, has looked at them to determine whether a reasonable employee may construe those rules as impeding their protected concerted activity. And I think the new test that we can see has been set forth by member Miscamara in the Beaumont case that he put out last April, and it talks about a decision or a test, rather, that would evaluate the employer's business justification for having such a rule, rather than looking at the context of the handbook, which has led to so many inconsistent and counterintuitive decisions, that we're looking at the context of the written rule and where it appears in the handbook or the rule book, for example, rather than to look to how it works in that facility. So that's going to be a very important change that we'll be looking for, I think, as soon as the first quarter, the first half of 2017. You set forth the test as it is here and how it's going to work better in balancing the business need with the employee's rights. They're not going to just allow employees' rights to go by the wayside, but the employer should have some say in it. Some other things we can expect, much maligned D.R. Horton and Murphy Oil cases, where the class action arbitration waivers have been subject to many complaints and have been getting mixed reviews in the circuits. I imagine the new board with a GOP majority would look to overturn or overrule those decisions. I think the joint employer decision that the NLRB issued in August of 2015 is going to probably not be overruled or reversed right away, but rather the test for direct or indirect control will likely lead to fewer findings of a joint employer relationship as the alleged parent or user employer will probably have less than direct control, and we'll see fewer of those decisions. And then looking down the road, we can think of a new GC, a Trump-appointed general counsel, may look at union activity. We saw that bannering cases in the NLRB found that union activity that declare an employer or a neutral employer is unfair without explaining why they're unfair, that was free speech activity. And I think we've seen those banners have gotten closer and closer to the front doors of our clients' establishments. They're hand-billing, and they've got banners. Is that picketing now? Are we moving back and forth? I think we're going to see some clarification as to what activity by unions is going to be considered picketing, in that it's confrontational or disruptive of an employer's business. And then the last thing, I think, and this is really kind of a hope for me rather than a prediction, is that we've seen a lot of union affiliation groups that have been out there doing what they can to support unions. And I think often they are really set up by unions, funded by unions, and they are acting on behalf of the unions. But because they are not actually labor organizations, they don't have to follow the same rules as a labor organization with regard to picketing or other confrontational or disruptive activity. And we've seen it most at airports where contractors working for the airlines have been organized, and there's been some disruption in different terminals. So I would be looking for the board to at least take a look at those organizations to see where they fit in the statutory framework. So that's a quick rundown of some change we might see, hope to see. So I'm going to turn it over now to my partner, Mike Rice, who's going to give us an overview of the EEOC, where he spent a little bit of time.
Thanks, Peter. You've been describing some fairly dramatic changes at the NLRB. I think at the EEOC, we're not going to see anything quite like that. I'd also like to provide some perspective based on my own personal experience. I was the regional attorney in Seattle in 79 and into the early 80s when the administration changed from Jimmy Carter to Ronald Reagan. And the chair of the EEOC went from Eleanor Holmes Norton, who became a congresswoman in Washington, D.C., fairly liberal and aggressive, to Clarence Thomas, who was quite the opposite. We saw big changes in priorities, but as you pointed out, on the local level, quite a bit less. You remember the EEOC is an enforcement agency. It enforces certain statutes. The statutes remain the same. It's a charge-based agency, so it relies on charges, 90,000 to 100,000 charges a year. And the local people enforce those. And so, you know, in terms of what the employers actually saw, there was a lot less difference. But in any event, in terms of what we're going to look for, I think we look at four things. We look at the commissioners. They're the ones who set the priorities for the agency. We want to see the general counsel. He's in charge of the litigation enforcement efforts. We'll want to look at budget. What level of budget are they going to get? That's going to affect staffing and allocation of staff. And we're always going to want to remember the local focus, that in the end, the employers face the people who are in the district offices. But let's start with the commissioners. The EEOC has five commissioners. They're each appointed to five-year terms, one a year. So over the last 8 years, President Obama has appointed all of the commissioners, but by law, no more than three can be with one from one party. So we have current lineup, three Democrats and two Republicans. The three Democrats are serving terms through July. Well, Jenny Yang, who's the current chair, will still be on through July of 2017. The new president will appoint a new chair. Jenny Yang will step down as chair in January. The acting chair will be Vicki Lipnick. She may become the permanent chair, or it may be somebody else who becomes the chair. But for the time being, through at least 2017, July of 2017, until Jenny Yang is replaced, we've got three Democrats and Vicki, and those four people have worked very closely together over the last several years to establish the agency's priorities and to embed them in the practices of the agency. So that's not likely to change. The EEOC went through a lengthy process to establish a strategic enforcement plan. It set priorities on what are the areas in which it was going to focus its enforcement resources, in addition to handling the charges that come in. Those six priorities have been, we've talked about them for a number of years, eliminating barriers to recruitment and hiring, protecting migrant vulnerable workers, addressing developing issues, enforcing equal pay laws, preserving access to the legal system, preventing harassment through systemic enforcement and targeted outreach. Those priorities are going to remain the same. There's not anything in the works to change them, and they're not likely to change. In fact, we'll talk about this later in a bit, the sixth priority, preventing harassment through systemic enforcement and outreach efforts, is likely to see more focus. Talk about that in a bit. With regard to the general counsel, David Lopez has already stepped down. We don't know who the next general counsel will be. In the past, when there have been Republican administrations, the general counsel has tended to come from the Labor and Employment Department of a major law firm, usually somebody who looks a lot like us, somebody from Akin Gump or Jones Day. There's not likely to be a huge change in enforcement efforts, except that we're likely to see a little bit more caution and not quite as much kind of pushing the boundaries. I think David Lopez has had a mixed record. He's had some successes that he's proud of, but he's also had quite a number of defeats that he talks about a lot less. I think that the enforcement by the EEOC will tend to be, you know, careful and thorough and statute-based, as opposed to a little bit of what we've been seeing. So, takeaways, what do you look for with the EEOC? It is a charge-based agency. It deals with the charges that come in. Retaliation is a major charge. That's going to still be a major charge. The statutes remain unchanged. Title VII, the Age Discrimination Enforcement Act, the Americans with Disabilities Act, the EEOC will still be enforcing all of those. The priorities will remain in place. With regard to harassment, it's interesting. The EEOC will make in the coming year a very concerted effort to deal with the persistent problem of harassment. It's been 50 years since the Supreme Court recognized that sexual harassment is a form of prohibited sex discrimination, and yet harassment persists. I mean, the EEOC has said that it could fill its entire litigation docket with harassment cases. And they're really trying to figure out, are there ways to get at this, not just through enforcement, but through outreach, through better training. I think the EEOC recognizes that a lot of sexual harassment training has been either ineffective or counterproductive. They're studying ways to make it more effective. So that's going to be a major push, but it's not one that I think that we would worry about. I think, in fact, we would welcome it. With regard to sexual orientation and identity, I mean, that's something that's been controversial, but I think the agency remains unchanged. The courts may dictate some changes in that area. But, you know, for us in the Pacific Northwest and on the West Coast, it's really not a major issue. I think sexual discrimination based on sexual orientation or sexual identity is prohibited throughout the Pacific Northwest, and that's not going to change, and policies are not going to change. In the long run, will the agency become more business-friendly? Probably. Vicki Lipnick, who comes from Seyfarth Shaw, is a real friend of business. It's interesting. One of the areas, she's worked very closely with Chai Feldblum on virtually every issue. They've come to agreement. The one in which Vicki and Chai have still not been able to reach an accommodation is on leave as an accommodation. And the business community has urged for years that the EEOC give some guidance that would set some bright lines for when a person out on leave can be replaced. Business community says, tell us what it is, 6 months, a year, whatever. We just like to know. The Chai Feldblum and the Democrat commissioners have said this is always an individual matter. I think Vicki Lipnick has been more amenable to the idea of some kind of guidance on this, and eventually we might see some of that. I put up the EEO-1 form because that's been something that employers have complained about. I think, unfortunately, it's still here to stay. The new EEO-1 form, which takes effect this year, does require the provision of extensive data. It's going to be somewhat burdensome and somewhat dangerous. Employers are going to have to look carefully at the data that they present to the EEOC before they submit, and we'll be providing, we at Davis-Wright will be providing some additional guidance on that. But I think basically you are not going to see major changes at the EEOC, at least for the time being. With that, I'm going to turn it over to Mike Killeen to talk about developments of the Department of Labor.
Yeah, thanks, Michael, for that perspective on the EEOC changes. And I'm going to talk about the Department of Labor, and the message is going to be largely the same. We're going to see some policy direction and change, and there's going to be some tone and emphasis change. But we're also not going to see some sort of sea change, I don't believe. About 5 years ago, I helped co-found the National Wage and Hour Defense Institute. We meet twice a year. We met in Chicago the day after the election, and I'll have to tell you, the mood in the room was elevated, but not euphoric. I mean, we all realize that there is a policy shift, but we don't expect that this is going to be something that will be significantly dramatic and reverse what existing law is for the most part. And I'm going to cover the areas we think the most likely changes are going to occur. First of all, you need to understand the DOL is a massive bureaucracy. It administers and enforces numerous federal laws and regulations that affect you. This includes everything from minimum wage to overtime to occupational safety and health to federal contractor affirmative action, prevailing wage, and so forth. I've listed only a handful of the agencies that are part of DOL. In terms of the personalities, and I think this goes back to something that both Peter and Mike were talking about with respect to other agencies, you have to understand the personnel involved, because these are the folks that are really going to have an influence on the policy direction. The president can give broad strokes, but it's these folks who really decide in a practical way where the tone and emphasis is going to be. So we have a departing Secretary of Labor. That's Tom Perez. He's an attorney. He had a background as an outspoken consumer advocate. He was a civil rights lawyer. When President Obama nominated him, he got considerable criticism from Senate Republicans and, no surprise, majority support from the AFL and CIO unions and so on. Now, the Trump nominee is, and by contrast, is someone who's the CEO of CKE Restaurants. He's frequently written and spoken on the management side regarding employment law issues. He is a lawyer, and I've put more of his background there on your slide. The key committees that are going to be involved here on the U.S. Senate and House side, I've outlined here their leadership personnel on those committees, both of which are majority Republican because the Republicans control both houses. These committee chairs, like Lamar Alexander and Jared Polis, are going to be real involved in overseeing the Department of Labor and setting policies. We expect the Putzer nomination to be challenged by the Senate Democrats, but the result's going to be the party in control, the Republicans, are almost certainly going to confirm him. In terms of what other changes can occur in personnel, they're relatively limited. Like Peter pointed out, a president doesn't have that many appointments among the thousands of individuals who work at these agencies. So he can appoint a new Secretary of Labor. He can appoint an assistant secretary that will oversee these various 29 agencies, and he can appoint one or two deputies for each of them. But otherwise, the career staff, the district directors, and so on, remain intact, and they're going to continue to enforce much of the law in the same way that they always have. The difference may be here in terms of some emphasis in, you know, where the policies go. Even though we've got the same law and a lot of the same personnel, there's going to be a policy shift in the emphasis on enforcement. There's going to be more education and outreach. In the back and forth cycle between Republican presidents and Democrat presidents over the decades, the typical pattern is the Republican administrations focus on education, they focus on outreach, and they place less emphasis on punitive enforcement, aggressive penalties, and the like. The number of inspections that are being done, and for DOL, it's about 33,000-34,000 a year. That's largely tied to their budget, and Republican administrations tend to slow or freeze the rate of growth in agency budgets, but not dramatically cut them back. So we can expect to see the number of inspections probably plateau at current levels in that 30,000-35,000 range. It's unlikely it'll decrease significantly. And in terms of litigation, that also will depend on DOL's budget as well as policy direction from the U.S. solicitor. And it remains to be seen who the new U.S. solicitor will be. That individual, like the GC at EEOC that Mike referred to, has a lot of the say in terms of the priority, in terms of what issues get litigated, and in terms of the direction of enforcement action. So we'll have to see a combination of budget and who the new U.S. solicitor is, but I would say that the number of enforcement actions, meaning lawsuits, charges, and so on, will likely plateau at current levels. We'll not see a significant decrease in that regard. The real issue will be private lawsuits, including collective actions, class actions. DOL has no control over that. That's private litigation, and they've been growing for 20 years at a rate of about 5% a year. And that's likely to continue and probably escalate. So we're not out of the woods when it comes to the litigation enforcement activity that's out there. Now, in terms of statutes and regulations, most of those will remain the same. There will be no wholesale repeal of statutes and regulations. We've seen some of the anticipated changes, and this is where commentators on all sides agree this is going to be a change. The FLSA white-collar exemption regulations have been enjoined. Those will die. The Trump administration will either not challenge the injunction, or they have some other multiple methods, and Congress can get involved too, and they will kill the current white-collar exemption regulation. The U.S. DOL persuader rule, that has also been enjoined. There's a permanent injunction. The Trump administration will not change that. The blacklisting executive order for federal contractors at the bottom there of the list, that is going away. That's going to disappear with a number of executive orders that the Obama administration put in place, and it's something that a President Trump can do with a stroke of a pen, and he doesn't need to go through any rulemaking or congressional action to do that. Now, the joint employer theory and the independent contractor issue, which is of big significance in our gig economy, is something that we believe will revert back to the traditional tests and the emphasis and expansion of this theory and the various attacks on gig businesses is going to de-escalate. And Peter alluded to that in the NLRB presentation, and the NLRB was the first one out of the chute on this. So as they gradually pull back, we're going to see the same thing, we think, in the DOL and other federal agencies. Now, there are some potential rules that could change. There's probably a 50-50 chance of this. This may be counterintuitive, but there is a real possibility that we'll see an increase in the federal minimum wage. There has been discussion among Republicans, and even the nominee for the Secretary of Labor, Andrew Putzer, has talked about increasing the $7.25 an hour to $9 or $10 an hour. And given that 29 states and the District of Columbia already have minimum wages above that level, doing something at the federal level in the $9 to $10 an hour range might be viewed by the Trump administration as kind of an olive branch, because it's not going to have a serious disruptive effect on employers and the economy. So they may actually go along with some of that. We also might see a move to bring an increase in the salary level for the white-collar exemptions. Even though the rule's going to go out, the automatic increase will go out, we might see something come back in the form of a new DOL rule that agrees to something like $35,000 a year as the threshold, because that has been the number. Had the DOL used traditional methods, that would have been the increase that most likely would have occurred if you just followed the sort of past formula that they've used. Now, whether the Trump administration will put a brake on proposed rulemaking regarding some of the OSHA regulations, such as the union-sponsored workplace violence regulations in healthcare, remains to be seen. Certainly, again, the emphasis is going to be on outreach, enforcement of current regs, de-emphasizing expansion and new rulemaking. Also, since candidate Trump was very critical of the way the Bureau of Labor Statistics measured and presented jobless data, and we have a director of the BLS whose term ends in January, we could very well have a new appointee that may be redirected to define jobless statistics to put more public emphasis on indicators relating to individuals not in the workforce, as opposed to those who are applying for jobless benefits when describing levels of unemployment. And then that will play into policy decisions. And then lastly, there is some speculation that a Trump administration might do something to curtail or suspend prevailing wage laws on the new infrastructure projects that candidate Trump campaigned on. So we'll have to see if that occurs. That would be a first strike at prevailing wage and right-to-work principles. The bottom line is that employers are going to find the Trump DOL to be more predictable, less antagonistic toward business. The number and pace of new requirements will be far less, and gotcha interpretations will largely disappear. But this doesn't mean zero headwinds in terms of labor and employment law for employers, particularly employers along the Pacific and Atlantic coasts. As you know, states and municipalities have dramatically increased and expanded laws involving minimum wage, paid sick leave, and other areas that DOL usually regulates. And several blue state governors have already said they intend to provide leadership with regard to taking more aggressive action than the federal government. So you can expect to see more action at the local level than the national level. And then in terms of federal judicial appointments, this is actually will be a favorable development for employers, because with a new Supreme Court appointee and a number of positions in the federal district courts and circuit courts of appeals, we're going to see judges that take a more plain or facial language approach to statutes and a more critical view of agency expansive interpretations or rulings when they're enforcing federal law. And this is going to provide more clarity, more certainty for employers as to what their statutory and regulatory compliance obligations are. So that's the overview regarding the DOL, and now we're going to get into what I think is going to be some of the more exciting and highly publicized issues that are out there in labor and employment law, and I'm going to turn this over to Deepa Sudra, who's going to talk about how Obamacare and other benefits issues are likely to fare in a Trump administration.
Okay, thanks, Mike. So I always like to talk about exciting things. So benefits is always exciting, as we know. And you know, in contrast to some of the other presentations you've heard this morning, I think there's a lot more substantive stuff that we can talk about and speculate on in the benefits world. So I want to set the scene a little bit. In reading a lot of the stuff that's out there, the quotes that are on this slide and the stats from this Kaiser Family Foundation poll really resonated with me. And the first one is from the proposed Treasury Secretary, who said, "Our number one priority is tax reform, and this is going to be the largest tax change since Reagan." Now, benefits are basically tax-driven, so I think we are going to see a lot of changes in benefits. But I'll start out by saying we kind of don't really know what they're going to be. And then you've got the American Hospital Association that said, "We urge you not to make any changes or any abrupt changes that could lead to significant instability for patients, providers, insurers, and others." And of course, this is talking about the ACA, which is going to form the bulk of what I'm going to talk about today. And some interesting statistics from the Kaiser Family Foundation poll. I know we're all a bit fearful of polls now, but apparently 26% of Americans want the entire ACA repealed. 17% wanted it scaled back, 19% want it to proceed untouched, and 30% want it expanded. So with that background, where are we? Well, President-elect's vision is, of course, to repeal and replace the ACA. Well, that's what the campaign was based on. With what? You know, perhaps a combination of HSAs, the high-risk pools or purchase of insurance across state lines. That wasn't really beefed up during the campaign. And I'm actually going to address a question that came in, which was, how likely is it that we'll see a HSA in every pot by 2018 as part of the health policy implementation? And the short answer is that we're not really sure how HSAs are going to play a role, other than knowing that they're going to play a bigger role than they did. You know, right now you need to have a high deductible health plan to be eligible for a HSA. I don't know if that requirement will still be there. I think we're going to see increased limits on HSAs so that you can put more money into them. But I think it's going to be a combination of HSAs along with other vehicles for which employees can reimburse themselves for medical expenses. So there'll be a bigger role for health reimbursement arrangements and a bigger role for health FSAs as well. So I think they'll come as a kind of a defined contribution health package together. But anyway, but back to the ACA. What's going to happen to it? I think in summary, it won't be completely repealed for a number of reasons. First of all, that's just not possible legally, and I'll go into that in a second. Secondly, there are parts of the ACA that are really quite popular, right? There's the ban on pre-existing condition exclusions, covering children up to age 26. People like this stuff. It's staying. It's not going anywhere. And then thirdly, there would be incredible disruption to the insurance markets and to people's healthcare coverage if you just took the whole thing away one day. So I think there'll be some repeal, and then there's going to be some kind of transition period as well. So what could be taken away? The Republicans need 60 votes in the Senate to totally dismantle the ACA, and they don't have that. So they're going to need to use the budget reconciliation process to get rid of certain provisions. And they've been practicing this for a number of years. So they've had a bunch of test bills where they use the budget reconciliation rules to try to get rid of the individual mandate and the premium tax credits that go with it, the employer mandate, the Cadillac tax, lifting the annual contribution limits to health FSAs, and lifting the prohibition on using your health FSA, your HSA, or your HRA to purchase over-the-counter medicines without prescription. So I think we might see these parts of the ACA fall away, and then that leads to the inevitable question of, well, if I don't have to comply with the employer mandate anymore, can I just not comply right now, to which my answer is no, we have rules in place right now. Just because we think they're going to change, I wouldn't advise not complying with the employer mandate or not complying with the reporting obligations. So there are, on this slide, you can see the types of provisions that are likely reconciliation proof, in the sense that they're not going away, I don't think. And really, they're kind of benign provisions, or they're provisions that people can't get excited about, right? Like, people love the prohibition on pre-existing condition exclusions, coverage of children up to age 26. I think that's staying. And then there are other things that the ACA had in there as well, like enhanced claims procedures and external review, prohibitions on annual and lifetime dollar limits. So, you know, benefits attorneys get really excited about this kind of stuff, but no one else does. So I don't think anyone cares if it really stays in the ACA. Now, in terms of what might we see as some kind of replacement, I don't really know what we're going to see, but we might be able to find some ideas from Paul Ryan's A Better Way. Some of his ideas are on this slide, and one of which is that right now, when employers make a contribution to your medical plan, you don't get taxed on it, but he wants to put a cap on that so that employers can't just pay for whatever plan they want for you and you get to reap the benefits. So we might see a cap on the 106 income exclusion. He wants to increase HSA contribution limits and allow standalone HRAs. Just as a quick aside, you may recall that the IRS basically stopped employers from saying to employees, hey, go out and go get a benefit plan and then I'll reimburse you for it, because the IRS interpreted that payment mechanism as a group health plan. And because it's a group health plan, it's subject to the ACA. And so employers couldn't do that anymore. That's actually going to change, because I think President Obama is about to sign the 21st Century Cures Act, and that would allow small employers to start doing that again. So there will be some extension of using HRAs. Paul Ryan would also allow the purchase of coverage across state lines, and I think he would severely roll back the EEOC's authority to regulate wellness incentives. The EEOC, of course, regulates the ADA side of the fence, but I think we might see some significant curtailment there. And then Tom Price, who is our proposed Secretary of Health and Human Services, he has some other ideas too. He likes the idea of giving tax credits for those without access to employer or government programs. He also likes to promote, or would like to see, a further promotion of health savings accounts, perhaps via some kind of tax credit that goes into the account, and maybe increasing the contribution limits. And again, you see this push towards these defined contribution type plans for employees who can, you know, use these types of plans to go out and perhaps buy their own plan, or perhaps even you know, use it to pay for a plan that their employer provides, or even some kind of plan that's out there in the market. And I think I didn't touch on this in Paul Ryan's slide, but he likes the idea of having some kind of employment package backpack. So in other words, you can just take it with you to whichever employer you happen to be with at that time. And this would, the defined contribution concept kind of neatly allows that, because then you could just use those dollars, if some of the rules get changed, to go out and buy whatever policy you want, and then you take it with you. And then what else we might see, I think we might see a removal of the requirement for health plans to cover contraceptive services. Right now, we've got a non-enforcement policy of the 105H, non-discrimination rules for fully insured health plans. I think we might see a continuation of that. We saw a bunch of proposed changes to Form 5500 proposed earlier in the year, and because a lot of those were ACA-driven, I wonder if we'll see a scaling back of that. And then there's Section 1557, so if any of you are fortunate enough to have federal funding in your plan, that means you have to comply with the non-discrimination rules of 1557. That might go away, or might be non-enforced. I'm just not sure. I think a big change is going to be also in the arena of childcare expenses. We're expecting to see some kind of daycare expense deduction, maybe even some kind of HSA for dependent care expenses, and we'll see some kind of incentives on employer on-site daycare. And then this is my last slide. I only have one slide on retirement, but I think given that we might see a wholesale tax reform, we're going to see big changes in retirements too. So there may be a cap on the amount that you can put into your 401k plan. Part of it might have to even be a Roth contribution, which of course is an after-tax contribution. And we might see some kind of freeze on the cost of living adjustments that we have become accustomed to, so that you can't contribute so much into your 401k plan. And then there's the fiduciary rule that's out there. I think the bottom line on that one is that we simply don't know what's going to happen. Commentators are all over the board with this one. Maybe it's going to be delayed. Maybe it'll be repealed eventually, or perhaps it gets revised. But we don't know. And I think that's really just a good way to summarize employee benefits next year. We just don't know. But we're going to be learning a lot. And with that, I'm going to hand you over to my colleague, Megan, who's going to talk about walls and things.
Thank you for that helpful information, Deepa. Throughout his campaign, Donald Trump emphasized immigration as a key issue that he would tackle early in his presidency. While it's not yet clear which of his campaign promises he will act on out of the gate, we can look to the handful of appointees and advisors he selected to see that there will be a definite shift in the tone and approach to tackling the issue of immigration during the Trump administration. Employers need to be prepared for what is likely coming, as certain Trump administration actions could cause them to lose valued employees and also bring their employment practices under the microscope of an administration that will emphasize enforcement and compliance more than we have seen under President Obama. You may be familiar with many of the Trump campaign's pledges regarding immigration, which he publicized on his website as his 10-point plan for immigration. Some of these include the $25 billion border wall, extreme vetting of immigrants from certain countries, and placing limitations on employer-sponsored work visa programs. This list demonstrates that Trump has some plans for dealing with immigration that will not only be very costly to implement, but also have a definite impact on your workplaces. Trump's proposed heads of the key immigration agencies have become clear over the last week or so. Retired General John Kelly has been nominated as Secretary of the Department of Homeland Security. Kelly is a blunt-spoken border hawk who formerly headed the U.S. military's Southern Command, including operations at Guantanamo Bay. Alabama Senator Jeff Sessions has been nominated for Attorney General. Sessions is a former U.S. attorney whose nomination for federal judgeship was tanked through reports of racist comments. He embraces a platform that would reduce immigrant flows into the U.S. and increase enforcement. Rex Tillerson, who is currently the CEO of ExxonMobil, has been named as Secretary of State. Tillerson has no foreign policy experience and very close ties to the Russian oil industry. So because of this, we think he may be subjected himself to some extreme vetting in the Senate confirmation process. Lastly, as Mike alluded to earlier, Andy Puzder from Carl's Jr. has been nominated for Secretary of Labor. Though he previously was outspoken in favor of amnesty-like programs of Obama, we expect him to come into line with the Trump pledges to support American workers by placing constraints on temporary work visa programs that the DOL oversees, like H-1B and H-2B. In 2012, President Obama enacted the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals program. This program has been very well received and has in certain quarters and has allowed roughly 800,000 individuals who are brought to the U.S. as children to gain work authorization and a temporary reprieve from removal. You may have some of these individuals working for you, and you can tell by looking at their employment authorization card, which includes a Category 33 listed on it. Because this program was an executive action, it could be canceled with the stroke of a pen by Trump. And it's kind of a rough situation for these individuals because they've turned over extensive personal information to the government. And if it's canceled, they would be in a kind of a limbo situation or status. Also, if the program is canceled, we're not really sure what will happen to their work authorization. It's possible that it could become void immediately or just not renewed after 2 years. There has been a significant push by members of Congress as well as community leaders, including college presidents, to urge Trump not to cancel DACA. There's presently a bill, two bills actually now, pending in the Senate to make the provisions of DACA a law. We also have a sense that Trump may be softening on his stance here. He said he's going to try to work something out for DACA recipients. For certain individuals who have not yet filed for DACA but who meet the eligibility requirements, we caution them to probably not apply right now. But if people who have already received DACA can probably apply to renew their work authorization. As you may have heard, Donald Trump has pledged to immediately deport up to 2 to 3 million individuals with criminal records. While this is not really a new policy, because as under President Obama, we've seen around 2.4 million people deported, and half of these people were immigrants with criminal convictions. What's new is Trump's insistence on doing this immediately. We're not really sure how he will achieve this, as there are currently huge backlogs in immigration courts, with cases taking over 2 years in many large cities, and there's currently 500,000 pending cases. So this area, in order to achieve his goals in this area, Trump would definitely need to increase funding substantially to the immigration courts. On the worksite front, we expect heightened enforcement through Form I-9 audits, and this could very well become a revenue producer for Trump, the Trump administration, to allow him to pursue other enforcement activities. We think this is the case because just last August, fines were nearly doubled for I-9 violations, We know that Trump's planning to increase the number of ICE officers and investigators threefold early in the year. So employers need to be very cautious about I-9 compliance and make sure that you're familiar with the new I-9 form, which will you must use by January 22nd. So now more than ever, I-9 training and internal audits are important. Under the Obama administration, employers saw the reduction in worksite raids in favor of I-9 audits, but we expect that this might resume under a Trump administration. And also, any employers who sponsor H-1Bs, L-1s, or J-1 non-immigrant workers in the U.S. should be prepared to receive site visits and audit inquiries from the USCIS and the Department of State. E-Verify has long been reported as coming as an inevitability for employers, and under the Trump administration, this very well may come true. Commentators worry, however, that adoption of E-Verify nationwide could be pretty disruptive for employers, as there reportedly are around 8 million unauthorized workers actually currently working in our labor force, and E-Verify adoption could have the risk of driving many people who don't have work authorization underground into exploitive jobs. Lastly, I just wanted to address a little bit about changes to legal immigration programs that we might see. During the campaign, the one visa program that Donald Trump focused on was the H-1B specialty occupation visa. There has recently been some press regarding certain issues at the Disney company regarding H-1Bs. And we expect to see, because of this, we expect to see more stringent enforcement of H-1B rules by the Department of Labor and USCIS, making it probably more difficult to get H-1Bs approved and more scrutiny of employer pay issues and compliance on that front. We could potentially see new regulations which would elevate the prevailing wage and also require employers to certify that they didn't bypass U.S. workers when hiring an H-1B. Trump has promised to either renegotiate or withdraw from NAFTA. That could reduce our ability to sponsor TN visas for Canadians and Mexicans. And lastly, I just want to address that next week we'll be seeing a pretty significant fee increase for USCIS filings across the board. But we see this as potentially, the Trump administration may also further increase USCIS fees just as a way to fund enforcement and employer monitoring activities that Department of Homeland Security would be involved with. So hopefully these points have helped to alert you to some changes which may be coming to on the immigration front. We'll now turn it over to Mike Killeen for some questions.
Yeah, thanks. In the few minutes we have, we'll cover a couple of things. I want to thank all the presenters around the table here for just on the fly, seat of the pants, covering questions that did come in. So we're in pretty good shape there. One question that I want to make sure everyone understands is that you can get a copy of the PowerPoints. It'll be on the handout tab on your screen as soon as we finish the presentation. We'll also post it on the Davis Wright, the DWT.com website, and we'll also have the audio of the webinar so you can replay it or share it with others. It'll probably take a couple days before it gets there, but there's a programs and presentation tab on our website that you could go to. So in a few minutes we have, I think what I'd like to do is just see if anybody around the table wants to react to anyone else's presentation or sort of give a sum up of the tips in the subject matter area that they've been addressing that employers should be ready for in 2017. And I guess, Mike Rice, let me start with you because I know you want to comment on the EEOC's limitations on wellness programs.
Well, thanks, Mike. No, Deepa said quite rightly that there's been a lot of criticism about the extent to which the EEOC has tried to impose constraints on employer wellness programs. Employer wellness programs are very popular. They're not going to go away. And as Deepa pointed out, Paul Ryan has talked about restricting the EEOC's ability to impose constraints on wellness programs through the ACA. The EEOC, though, enforces the Americans with Disabilities Act, and the EEOC has stubbornly regarded many of the aspects of wellness programs as potential violations of the Americans with Disabilities Act, particularly imposing penalties on people and the extent to which there are penalties for non-participation in programs. Whatever happens with the ACA, the EEOC will still enforce the Americans with Disabilities Act, and there is a tension between these two statutes. So I just wanted to clarify that the EEOC's enforcement of the ADA will remain.
Thanks, Mike. Peter, Deepa, Megan, any of you want to comment on anything or underscore something? Okay, so I think the message, at least from Peter and myself and Mike Rice, is that in the NLRB, EEOC, and DOL areas, I mean, what you've got to gear up for in 2017 is to do your usual risk management. The law's not changing. The enforcement's still going to be there. You need to audit. You need to comply. The traditional laws and rules are going to be there. There may be some significant policy issues that get changed. And we also have to be aware of developments at the state level and private litigation. Those are things that the federal government has no control over, and there will be aggressive action still in those arenas. One more question before we close that's come in, Mike Rice, and that has to do with whether the LGBTQ rights you think will be impacted by a Trump EEOC.
Well, I think the EEOC has taken the position that the statute's prohibition on discrimination based on sex includes discrimination based on sexual orientation, sexual identity. They have a number of theories upon which they base that analysis, but they've taken that position. That faces some headwind in the courts. The EEOC is not likely to change its position at any time in the near future. We'll see how that plays out in the courts.
Okay, thanks everyone. We had a great time preparing for this. We hope you enjoyed the presentation. And again, you can download the PowerPoints and you can also look on our website for a copy of the audio webinar in a couple of business days. Thanks.
Thank you. A link to an online evaluation form is now displayed on your screen. Please take a few minutes to complete it. We do appreciate your feedback. This concludes today's webinar. Thank you for attending.